You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
We are also, of course, on the web to the world, www.abc.net.au/Sunday Nights. I mentioned that web address because we've had a number of calls wanting to link in to postvention, that is, how to deal with the trauma of those left behind after a friend or a loved one has committed suicide. Postvention, a major conference in Melbourne this week, the second Australian postvention conference called Connectedness, A Link to Hope. And if you want to find or get access to many of those postvention services which are available around Australia today, do go to our website. We'll put them up. We'll even put details about courses up that you can do if you want to be alert to the issue and be able to recognise people who may be in prone to suicide and where to go for help, those sorts of things, all going up on our website. You can also resume this conversation after the news in about a couple of hours' time. Right now, we're going to meet one of Sydney's great church musicians, somebody who after 30 years has finished up his term with St. Mary's Cathedral after papal tours and international visits. David Russell is our guest. Laude Jerusalem Dominum, the choir of St. Mary's Cathedral in Sydney under the direction of David Russell. David Russell has just concluded his tenure as conductor of St. Mary's Cathedral Choir after some three decades at the centre of Sydney's musical life, and David is our guest this evening. David Russell, welcome.
Thank you.
David Russell, what initially was the attraction of music for you? What was the first thing that said to you, "Ooh, I'm going to take this seriously"?
I'll take it seriously. Well, I had a mother who was musical, and she liked to play the piano, and of course that attracted me earlier. But really, what pushed me in the direction I went was one evening I was a regular Argonauts Club person listening to the ABC. And there used to be a program by Mr. Melody Man, who was Lindy Evans. And he ended up being my piano teacher, actually, later on.
How old were you at this stage?
Oh, golly, I'm talking 8, 9. I mean, the search for the Golden Boomerang and the Argonauts Club followed themselves with such regularity that it's hard to pinpoint where or which one. But I would have been about 8 or 9. For some reason, Mr. Melody Man was not present. He was around accompanying someone around Australia as an accompanist at that stage. And instead they played some music from some recently released recordings in England called the Oxford History of Music and Sound. And most of it was kind of not a particular interest to me until one piece was played and I froze. It was kind of like, what's that? And I waited till the end and they back announced it. And it was so complicated sounding that the best I could do was grab a piece of a mother's dressmaking chalk and write it on the wall of the back veranda phonetically. Well, of course, it was a big mystery and a secret till a bit later in life when I was actually performing bits of music like this, and I found out it was the Sanctus from Palestrina's Missa Papamacelli. And the incredible weaving of sound and, it had an enormous effect. And that's really the first strongest thing I can remember.
This is some indication of some precociousness as a child?
I grew up in very confusing circumstances. I was born in England, but I was born just as my family was planning to come to Australia. It was 1937. And war talk was around everywhere.
You were an awkward interruption.
I was a very awkward interruption. And when I was born in 1937, I developed rheumatic fever straight away. So I was a health problem for them as well. And they missed their ship. So we had to wait till 1939 when we came out to Australia. And that was crossing the Indian Ocean when there was U-boat activity. We landed in Sydney, and pretty soon after, I don't know exactly how soon, war was declared, and my father joined up to the army.
When did you first become aware of the other great part of your life, that is, the church, of religion as an institution? Was this as a child?
I don't know. I have very mixed signals about my family and whether I actually felt I belonged to it or not. That's extremely hard. I know that they didn't they weren't church people in any way at all.
They're sort of nominal Anglicaners.
That's right, exactly so. And at about the age of 7, because of all these tensions, which I don't want to go into, I achieved a nervous breakdown. The outcome was the paediatrician said to my parents, look, this boy can never go into a competitive environment. He doesn't have that kind of a personality. And we suggest a private school. Well, we were living by this stage at one of the flats that had emptied out in Bellevue Hill, Rose Bay, when the Japs had fired bombs or rockets from their subs in, and they were going cheap. So the nearest private school was Waverley College. Now, I don't think my parents would have cared whether it was Calathumpians or anything at all. It was just there, and I ended up there. Now, anyone who's an ex-Waverley boy would know that it's not the school to describe as non-competitive. And it was absolutely full-on competitive in sport, in cadets, in everything.
But it was Catholic.
It was Catholic, and Irish Catholic to boot at that stage. And the Irish Catholics had their beef, and my father had his beef with the Irish. And he used to say, they sleep with the pigs, and I used to think, well, yeah, that's a bit strange, you know, to be doing that. I didn't realise that the inference was that the pigs were the Nazis who were in Ireland, and his strong resentment. So it meant I had to be Irish at school and English at home. I eventually worked.
So this is a world at war socially and at home as well.
That's right.
For you.
Yes. Yes. So I escaped into my head.
Was there a moment of magic, that is, that the church as an institution captured you, that you in some ways became a substitute for your family? I mean, I'm not trying to be too psychological. Yeah,
it never became a substitute for the family, but it became part of a certain fondness for things medieval. I don't know where that came from, but it was certainly present in my life.
What was there a magical moment for you, though, when all of a sudden you made a decision, oh, this is for me, that it's not just being at a Catholic school, but the church is something that I wish to identify with?
Look, little old ladies used to get romancing about, you know, he's a convert and so young. I don't think that was the story at all. When I decided I was going to become a Catholic and I told the brothers, the brother who had my class at the time, Brother Dwyer, said, well, you've been attending all the religion classes. I can't see that there's any need for special instruction. So a date was set up with the Franciscan friars at Mary Immaculate Waverley for me to be baptised. And it was a strange introduction because I went over on a Friday afternoon. My parents didn't come or anything like that. That wasn't on. And this Franciscan friar came out, and there were two other people there who I believe were to become significantly connected to me in the form of Godfather and Godmother, whom I've never seen since again in my life. And we went into the little baptistry, and water was poured on my head, and the ominous words, if thou art not already baptized, I baptize thee in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. In those days, we just didn't trust other religions to dispense the sacrament properly, I suppose. Anyway, this was followed on the Saturday by First Confession. So this was the second big sacramental whoopee. And that was extraordinary because I'd been told all the things that were suitable to confess, forgetting morning prayers, forgetting evening prayers. But I'd not been prepared for the question which came from the priest, which was, perhaps you could tell me a sin from your past life. Now, to the best of my knowledge, Catholics didn't believe in past lives. Oh, no, I didn't know anything about my past life. So I made stuff up. Of course, there was nothing else I could do. Well, that set the ball in rolling because First Communion was to be the Sunday morning in the college chapel. And I got myself up and got dressed for it, went into my parents' room to say, I'm going over to church now to make my First Communion. And I got the typical, well, that's nice, lad. And then my mother put her finger on somewhere on her cheek, indicating the preferred spot for a kiss today. And so I kissed her, and as I did, she popped a chocolate into my mouth. Now, Catholics in those days didn't eat anything before they received the Eucharist. And I thought, what am I going to do? And so I tried to say to Mother, I can't go over. And she said, no, you don't understand, David. Chocolate's the exception. And I thought, my mother's become so knowledgeable about the dietary rules of Catholicism. This is extraordinary. Well, I sat with that all the way over to the church where the brothers had sort of prepared a breakfast for me and had a few of my class people in for it and that.
And here you were in a state of mortal sin?
Absolutely, absolutely. And stayed in that state of mortal sin for 2 or 3 years until I got the guts to tell the story in confession. And then I got shouted at and I thought, confession is really scary. Apart from that, Sunday school at St. Stephen's Bellevue Hill was all about sand trays and standing little figures in it and that just didn't interest me at all.
Yes, the Anglicans were not particularly good at Sunday school. The Catholics had a lot more colour.
A lot more colour, yes, and a lot more chance for the exotic, I suppose. It's a very difficult.
When did it all begin to come together for you? You mentioned to us that musical moment you have when you're about 7 or 8. Is this about the same period that you're finding the Catholic Church as well?
9 would be that here. And there was a group of us up the road from where we lived was the manager of the local classy cinema at Bondi Junction, the Regal. And next door to him lived a man called Ken Hall, who was famous in movies.
One of Australia's great movie directors.
Yeah, yeah. And one of my friends at school was the son of the Regal proprietor. And he and his sister and I and that used to play this game called Playing Mass. Now, I didn't know what was going on, but this sort of dressings up and pretending to be involved in all of this was the game that was being played, and I was too insecure to want to change the game. So I went along with it. And they used to distribute the Eucharist in a form of a black Marilla tube. Why on earth they chose black, I don't know. But you only got 2 licks and then it was whipped out of your mouth. It was Michael's right to consume the lot at the end.
This is the mystical rites of David Russell we're talking about on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. By some strange transmogrification, David Russell has become one of Australia's eminent choral directors and for 30 years the director of music at St Mary's Cathedral in Sydney. David Russell, let's snatch a little from your later experience as one of the great conductors in Sydney. And a piece of popular music, now a popular hymnody almost, Jesus Christ the Apple Tree.
Thank you.
Jesus Christ, the Apple Tree, David Russell and the choir of St. Mary's Cathedral. David, you've taken us through a very entertaining sort of introduction to the mysteries of the church. But a little later on, you became identified with St. Mary's Cathedral in particular.
Yes.
How did that happen? You developed an interest and an aptitude in choral music, and at some point comes the opportunity.
No, it didn't work like that.
Didn't work like that? No.
I'd started this fascination for things medieval, and this led me to a stage where I started to explore. And after school each day, I used to catch the Bronte tram into town and go to the Mitchell Library, because my parents didn't stop work until 5:30, and I didn't dare tell them I was doing this. I don't know why I'd be scared of telling them, but I didn't. And I found where the architecture books were, and I found books on all sorts of interesting people, like Pugin and the Gothic Revivalist and all of that, plus the real things. And this kind of romantic view of life was what I elected to go with up in my head. It was, and I would watch things like Henry V with Sir Laurence Olivier, and I just find that so wonderful.
Well, that high Victorian Ivanhoe melodrama sentiment was very popular in the late 19th century, and certainly well into the 20th century, up to the Second World War. I mean, you weren't alone in that sort of romantic
vision. No. I don't claim to be an unicorn. That's what happened. But there was an afternoon, because you want a moment, when I'd been in the library, and I came out of the gates opposite the Botanic Gardens, and instead of turning left to go down and catch my tram, I decided to turn right. I don't know why I decided to turn right. And as I came round the library building, there across the other end of the domain was the pile of St. Mary's Cathedral. Now, I'd never ever been in it. I didn't know anything much about it. It was a lot more visible then, because the trees hadn't grown as high to sort of cover half of it. But it was at that moment I knew, and this is going to sound like magic thinking to some people, but I knew I was going to end up director of music at St. Mary's Cathedral.
How old were you?
15.
So your life then, subconsciously, had an arc to it already.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You recognised at that point.
Oh, I knew. It makes no sense to use any other word, because I knew. And that sense of certainty about things, I've been lucky enough to happen several times in my life. But it's an awkward thing to talk about unless you're talking with people of like mind, as it sounds a bit sort of mumbo-jumbo-ish. But that's it. That's what happened.
So how did fate conspire to bring you to that place?
Once I'd been in St. Mary's Cathedral once, it became a bit of a haunting place for me, you know. And I found a magazine in the public library called Building. And I looked up the years 1926, 27, 28, when the major part of the cathedral was being completed. And there were these wonderful series of photographs of the place being built. It looked extraordinary. I then started to wonder what the music was like. And in my leaving certificate year, I was at school, I was about 15, 16. At the end of the year, I talked myself in and asked to join the choir. Now, the choir that was there at that stage was an adult choir of many very well-meaning, but they were people who'd actually developed their skills during the war when there wasn't much choice, all right? And they sang appalling music, as far as I was concerned. It certainly wasn't like the music I wanted to hear.
And this was a mixed choir?
Mixed choir, a very old mixed choir. I was suddenly very
doing
young.
Their best.
Yes, that's right. Okay. And I sang with them for end of 1953, 54. And then midway through 1955, a notice appeared in the Catholic Weekly announcing the formation of what in those days was called the liturgical choir. That was a choir of men and boys who were basically there to sing the offices of the church.
This was to take things seriously.
Yes, that's right. Pius X, the Pope around the turn of the century, had issued a motu proprio in which he wanted to encourage the re-establishment of maîtrises or choir schools or whatever you want to call them, for the musical education of the young, and also, I suppose, to sort of guarantee some kind of clergy that would be able to perform the necessary rites.
So here's your big chance. The church is going to take music seriously instead of being a sort of popular sort
That's
of amusement
right.
for a few people who've got nothing better to do. All of a sudden, here's the opportunity to...
But it was a bit convoluted because at the same time the Pope was sounding off against music, which I found particularly attractive, such as the masses of Haydn and Mozart, and he banned these, and I couldn't believe it.
It took the church a while to catch up. So you joined this new choir? You became part of this new choir?
Well, yes, three of us. I talked another guy I knew at that stage to come and join with us, and there was an old guy who was wonderful, full of stories about the history of the place, called Arthur Anderson. He was allowed to come up too. He would have been in his 60s. So we were the link across, actually, to this new choir under Father Ronnie Harden.
Now, we do the church a bit of a disservice in that there had been some musical tradition at St. Mary's. In fact, you've recorded a mass by Delaney, an early St. Mary's music master.
Look, of course, there'd been a continuous musical tradition at St. Mary's. It just wasn't the musical tradition that I thought appropriate. You know, there's an arrogance of being young, which is... And then when the Pope had said these things, I agree with him.
Well, let's have a listen to a little of that tradition under your direction, a selection from the Delaney Mass.
Thank you.
The choir of St Mary's Cathedral, Sydney, under the direction of David Russell, taking us back into the history of St Mary's with an excerpt there from the Delaney Mass. David Russell, you've been honoured by the church. You're a papal knight. How did that come to be?
I'd received a grant from Sydney Uni to research the music of Albert Delaney and get it up to a performance possibility. And that I did, and I used the Conservatorium Orchestra, because I was lecturing there at the time, and the Cathedral Choir and the Conservatorium Choir, and we put on this performance.
And is that why you got the papal knighthood?
Well, it was given to me on that night of the performance. I didn't know it was coming. I was a bit flabbergasted. Of course, I'm a bit rebellious about these things. I'm a Republican from way back. I don't want to seem ingracious.
Modesty in all things. Delaney was an early choir master. Does that music have any virtue other than its antiquarian value?
Oh, well, it has an antiquarian value. It's also kind of Australia's missing romantic opera, you know. It has all the sort of echoes of Massenet and lots of things, and that was the musical culture of the time. But it was rehearsed seriously. Now, the same man that wrote this, though, gave the first Australian performance of Elgar's Dream of Gerontius with the Cathedral Choir. Now, that's a taxing demand, so their performance standards must have been quite reasonable.
You mention Elgar and the Dream of Gerontius. We're entering into a period where English choral music, through the late 19th century, the early 20th century, comes into a bit of a golden age. Do you see that reflected too in the spirit of people wanting to actually establish this new choir at St Mary's in the early 50s? There was something to aspire to.
Gosh, it'd be lovely, you know, to sing Australia's praise and say that, but I don't think they were thinking like that at all. I think it was more a matter of, oh, look, you know, the Pope in 1903 said we should do this. It's now 55, that's just over 50 years later.
We
just better do it.
Was it a bit of a struggle for the women in this?
It was, look, there was one lady I came in on the tram and went home on the tram with every Sunday, and she was heartbroken. It had been a life, you know.
Yes, because it did mean going back to an all-male.
You know, the church can be hard and in these things. They're not very often pastorally attuned to people who have got more sensitive feelings or something. They were just told they weren't wanted from a certain date, and that was it. I think they were all taken out for a dinner after it, you know. That was it, though. What had been their lives was no more.
This change, harsh as it was for some, marked the beginning of real opportunity for you.
Well, yes. The first choir master in this new regime was Father Ronnie Harden. He founded it in 1955, and he was there until the papal visit of Paul VI.
You were a bit of a performer in that
time. Oh, well, yes, that's right. There exists somewhere a recording.
Look, we might even have just a snatch of the voice of David Russell, the visit of Pope Paul VI to Australia. And this is a composition of yours, David.
Yes, I wrote this music.
David Russell, performing for Paul VI in Australia. David, this also marks the beginning of your maturity in terms of assuming direction for the choir, increasing responsibility for the choir, and eventually becoming choir director.
Well, yes, you could say on the start. Actually, there was someone else who came in after Father Harden, another priest who happened to be the nephew of Cardinal Gilroy, one of the archbishops. He had the choir for about 6 years, I think. And look, there's a lot of history around that, which I don't think appropriate to go into. But eventually, when he resigned, I got asked in. And the reason they asked me in was because my predecessor, every time he needed a replacement, while he went off and did a course or something overseas, called upon me. And so when the position became vacant, the Archbishop said, well, why not the big man, which was how he referred to me. And so that came about.
We mentioned the motu proprio, which eventually St Mary's caught up with in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the 1960s also marked huge change for the church with Vatican II. And Vatican II meant a profound cultural change, which got reflected in music not always comfortably and not always with the best direction. I mean, the 1960s not only marked a high point and a revival for quality music of the sort you're associated with, but it also marked that point where people were encouraged to go off and use guitars and whatever else to fulfil their musical ambitions. Did this become a continuing tension for a little while?
It continues to be a continuing tension. Look, I believe this sincerely. Before Vatican II, we had one language, Latin. So whether you were a Czech composer or whether you were an Australian composer, your church music was performable all the world wide over. Now, after Vatican II, with the change of liturgical language into a variety, music written in specific languages was not as readily available, didn't get the same performances, and then in the end tended to be judged by its own cultural tenets. Now, America's great for musical comedy, so it's understandable that a significant number of their compositions would have the echo of a show tune about them. And because America dominated much of the world culturally in both positive and negative ways, we had groups come up like Lucien Dees and the St. Louis Jesuits and that. And because this was very approachable, non-intellectualized music, parishes picked it up. But it happened at the risk of an enormously rich tradition.
What it gained in relevance, it lost in universality.
Exactly. And no one argues that point.
Well, except this current Pope.
Well, the current Pope, very much so. But again, you know, he's very musical. I know his brother very well, and I've had the choir over in Regensburg, and he's sat with us and that. And they know what they're talking about. They understand Vatican II perfectly. But they also understand there's a responsibility to preserve the inheritance, to preserve the tradition.
There is a legitimate tension here, though, is there not, between immediate relevance to the congregation and the need to preserve the tradition at depth?
You're an ABC man. You must know all about this kind of tension between what they want out there and what people think's good for them. That's always going to be in music. There's always going to be a higher quality of music in certain places, and that's appropriate. I mean, if we're welcoming a very important guest to Australia, and we want to welcome them with a musical opening to their visit or something, we don't choose the latest Tin Pan Alley choice. We go for something that we think's appropriate.
Well, let's hear a little echo of what we've been talking about with some of Georg Ratzinger's handwriting that you've brought back from Germany for the Cathedral Choir. Well, Missa Vita Speciosum.
Yes, but he gave me this score because that was the work they'd performed on the Sunday we were in Regensburg, and he gave me a copy of it. So when the Pope was coming to Sydney to say Mass in the Cathedral and dedicate its new altar, I already knew that it was very well liked by George Ratzinger, and he told me that it was his brother's favourite polyphonic Mass. So
here we go.
Thank you.
Music given by Georg Ratzinger, the brother of Pope Benedict, to the choir of St. Mary's Cathedral and performed for the Pope under the direction of our guest, David Russell. David, let's talk about a few of the highlights in the choir's history under your tenure. For you, there were a couple of European tours, performing in Paris, recording in Paris.
Two European tours and one American tour. The only thing that really stopped us touring was when the Australian dollar had the bottom fall out of it, because we had to raise all our own money for touring.
And there aren't many choirs in the Catholic tradition in the 60s and 70s and 80s that were in the touring business. There were certainly one or two internationally, but in Australia, church music itself went through a time of great decline. You were one of the few who tried to preserve a rich tradition.
Yes.
This meant, really, that your immediate reference points had to be overseas.
Yes, and it was because, it's a very long story, how I met these people overseas and how I decided to take it. It was another one of those inspired moments. If you remember when we opened the Eastern Suburbs Railway, one day I was on the train taking it up to King's Cross, and as I looked around, I thought, gosh, this is just like the U-Bahn in Munich where I'd recently been. And that got my mind thinking, and I thought, I wonder if I can do this. I wonder if we can go over. By the time I'd reached the station, I'd made up my mind we were going. Now, I don't know of any church choirs who had toured before then. I know there are some, like Christ Church St. Lawrence, that do a regular touring amount now and have followed up. Interesting, two members of the choir of Christ Church came with us, one as an assistant organist, and the other, who's a sound recordist with the ABC, Owen Chambers, came as our tech man and recorded everything for us.
It was a bit brave, taking an Australian choir into the heart of European cathedral life.
Coles to Newcastle, is that the implication? Well, yes. But we did take over music they didn't, some music, a fair amount actually, they didn't know. Music by English composers and some Australian composers. Music like by Benjamin Britten and Vaughan Williams and even the ubiquitous Australian Christmas carols.
So did you target a niche? Did you say, okay, in doing this, what we need to do is take our own repertoire, something that will surprise them?
Certainly part of it, yes. But I also had to find my in to a group of people who possessed a heated performing venue and a performing venue that would attract people to come to concerts there and with their own musical tradition. And it was just by luck or provided or the will of God, I don't know which, that two German musicians, one the president of an organization called Puri Cantores and the other was the vice president of Puri Cantores, which was on about getting young people to sing decent church music, came out to Australia and I put them up and got to know them. So when I said to them, look, I'm interested in bringing the choir to Europe, don't worry, we'll arrange it all. We'll arrange it. We'll arrange billeting. We'll arrange a whole lot. It became possible because I didn't have to pay for those.
How was it received?
Over there, oh, look, it was great. I mean, of course, I look at it with the misty eyes of sort of distance, but I was flicking through the reviews of the various concerts, and we were reviewed by some serious places like the Frankfurter Allgemeine, which is a serious newspaper, not just the normal local Sonntagblatt. And they spoke sensibly about the different colour that Australian children have. And that was always been one of my big things, that we risk trying to make Australian children sound like English children, which is not the natural, open, sunny colour of their voices.
I recall being referred to one headline which says, an astounding Australian boys' choir.
Yes. Yes.
This is high praise indeed.
Yes, it certainly was. And, you know, a couple of times they earned it.
Ever the choir master. Ever the choir master. David Russell, we're rapidly running out of time, but let's glory in the some of the high moments of your experience with St. Mary's. Let's take a piece of music now. This is from Guno, a Gloria from Guno. Gloria from A Mass My Guno, a selection of our guest, David Russell, for many years the director of St. Mary's Choir at the Cathedral in Sydney. David Russell, you've reached the end of your term at St. Mary's. Passing the baton is always difficult. And you mentioned earlier that that experience you had back in the 50s where, with a new choir and a new age, some of the women found it very difficult to have to give up what had been their life. It must be a difficult time for you too. I mean, we mark transitions in our lives. Something's got to go and something new comes along.
Yes, that's true. I mean, letting go of something. You think of Job, you know, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And seriously, that's an issue one has to come to terms with. But I've given myself other tasks. I've gone and joined a parish choir as a singer, where I can get the pleasure of singing the music and yet not the responsibility. And I'm doing a lot of writing. I'm writing a set of memoirs of myself with the choir and things like touring and all of that. And I'm enjoying myself. So I'm not finding it a great problem.
You don't find it a bit of a strain when you sit there in the parish on Sundays and you think, oh, my goodness.
No, I don't. This parish does extremely well and it takes the liturgy seriously. I'm talking St. Benedict's Broadway, which isn't far from here. And they're lovely people. And no, I'm having a lovely time. I'm very fortunate to be able to share that space with them.
David Russell, it's been wonderful that you've given us your time this evening. Let's go out on a high note with the St. Mary's Cathedral Choir, Resonant in Laudibus. Just tell us why you've selected this as a final.
Right, this was actually recorded by us at a reception by the French president in the Lycée Palace. And it was just lucky that we got the recording done. Because we were standing on this marble staircase and the boys had been sneaking into all the food and a little bit of champagne, I think, went astray. And then we were asked to sing something and we weren't prepared. So I just thought of the first thing in my head that I thought they might have memorised, and it was the Resonant in Laudibus. And they were in a high. It was just wonderful. It just sparkled off. So I included it on the CD of our tour. They had the Australian diplomatic corps there. And he came up to me and he said, we've been trying to tell the French for a long time that Australia is not an English enclave in the southern part of the world, but is very multicultural. And tonight you've demonstrated more than anything we could prove. Because when I look at the Cathedral Choir now, it's every colour. It's every race. It's not just pale-faced lads in ruffs anymore at all. It's a very different looking thing.
David Russell, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night.